Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Sunbury Press Authors Interview. I'm Van Carter. As the computer nerd in the movie Jurassic Park warned just before he rebooted the system, hold on to your butts. The book is titled The Most Hated Man in America, Jerry Sandusky and the Rush to Judgment. It was written by Sunbury Press author Mark Pendergrast, and I have him as my guest. It's an important book and an important subject, and those of you who have thought this was a closed subject need to sit and listen. It's far from a settled case. Mr. Pendergrast, I thank you for giving us some time with this. I'm bursting with thoughts and questions, but I guess we need to put this in some kind of order first, right?
Yes, well, thank you for having me, Van.
Yeah, encapsulate it as well as you can. It's a huge story, but do what you can with it.
Well, I came to believe that Jerry Sandusky was innocent after looking very closely at the case. When I first heard about it, I thought, like I think everybody else, that of course he was guilty. There were so many people who had come forward. Eventually, there were over 30 who claimed that he had done something to them. Plus, the most famous incident was the assistant coach who had witnessed him abusing a child, sodomizing a boy, a 12-year-old boy, in the shower. So there seemed to be no question that that was the case. But a woman contacted me and said, you know, you really ought to look into this case. It involves a fair amount of repressed memory therapy, which is something I had written a book about, questioning that people could really repress memories and then recall them later in life. That, as a matter of fact, most of the bad things that happen to you, you recall them quite well, thank you.
Quite well. And so, you've written two books.
Yeah, I wrote a book called Memory Warp, about the repressed memory epidemic that really began in the late 1980s and continues, unfortunately, although it's sort of under the radar. It's been pretty well debunked, this idea that Freud had 100 years ago that you could be abused for years of your childhood and completely forget it and then recall it as an adult. You can't disprove that. But it doesn't make any sense according to what memory scientists tell you, and I couldn't find one convincing case where people forgot years of abuse. I did find a few cases where people forgot mild incidents like a fondling, a one-time event, and then recalled it, but I don't think that's repression. I think it's just normal remembering and forgetting. At any rate, so when this woman told me that I should look into the case, I'll look into anything. So I did. But the first thing I said to her was, what about Mike McQuarrie? We all know what he saw and heard in the shower. But it turns out that he also changed his memory, although I don't think it had to do with repressed memory particularly. All of our memories are subject to malleable suggestion, particularly if there's been a long period of time between them. So when McQuarrie saw, he didn't really see anything. What he did was he overheard slapping sounds in a shower, and he thought that they sounded sexual. So this was in probably December of 2000, although he recalled it later as being a few months later, 1 month later, but it probably was actually in late 2000. He came into the shower. He heard slapping sounds. He looked into a mirror in the locker room. He saw a boy's face, didn't look surprised or shocked or upset, and he saw a man's arm grabbing the boy and pulling him back into the shower. And then later, he saw Sandusky and the boy walk out of the shower. He assumed that he had been present for sexual abuse of this boy. But he went home, and when he asked, when he told his father and his father's boss about this, he told them what I just said. And his boss, who was, you know, used his mode of, who was a doctor who asked people normally what happened, said, but what did you see, Mike? What did you see? He just kept saying that he had overheard these sounds. So they told him, and by the way, so the doctor is a mandatory reporter. If you suspect child abuse, you have to report it.
Right.
He didn't. He didn't. He
but
said,
he didn't suspect,
look,
Mike, he didn't suspect child abuse because of what he'd heard.
No. He basically said, you know, Sandusky is well known for goofing around and playing around with kids. So maybe he was doing something wrong, maybe he wasn't. But you should tell this to Coach Paterno. And so he did. He went and told Coach Paterno that he had overheard something that he thought was upsetting. And Paterno, later on, in his mid-80s, thought that maybe he had told him that he had seen something. But in fact, that's not what he said at the time. So cut to 10 years later, the police are investigating Sandusky because of another reported incident. They heard that McQuarrie had seen something. So they went and questioned him. And now he recalls that he saw Sandusky moving his hips, quote, subtly behind this boy in the shower. He said he saw these, quote, subtle movements for about 1 or 2 seconds, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But anyway, so that is the crux of this case, is the sighting in the shower, and it doesn't hold up. And McQuarrie himself, ironically, was in the habit of sending pictures of his erect penis to women on the phone, on his phone, texting pictures. And, you know, I suspect that the sounds that he overheard were from maybe his own heated imagination. Now, I know
Jerry
what happened
Sandusky
in that
was
shower.
A big kid. I'm sorry to interrupt, Mark, but Jerry Sandusky was a big kid. He was a man, but he loved kids. He was a big kid, so that was horseplay. All of these people up the line that were reported to, well, they actually called him in and asked him about it, and he said, well, it was just horseplay, and they knew that's what he did.
That's what he said, but he also said, do you want to talk to the kid that was in the shower?
Yeah.
I'll be glad to have you talk to him. And his boss said, no, don't worry about it. It's okay. You explained it, but we don't want you coming to the campus anymore with kids. It doesn't look good, so don't do it. Well, I wish that he had said, yes, I want to talk to that kid. Because his name was Alan Myers. Alan Myers came forward after this whole thing blew up in November of 2011, and he gave a statement to Sandusky's lawyer saying, look, I remember that night very well. We were slap boxing with each other. We were snapping towels at each other. That's the sounds this guy overheard. Jerry Sandusky never abused me in any way. He was a father figure to me. I had him stand up instead of my father at my senior high school football game. I drove for many hours to attend his mother's funeral. I lived with the Sandusky family for a summer after I graduated. And, you know, this is an ex-Marine, and that's what he said. Now, you would think that that would have settled this case and he would have been called to testify, but in fact he was not called to testify because about 2 weeks after he gave that statement, he flipped. He got a lawyer named Shubin, who represented many of the Sandusky people who...
A contingency of a lawyer.
Yeah. Yeah, a contingency lawyer. You know, I'll take your case for free as long as I get 25% of everything that we get from the case, or something
exactly
along those lines. So Myers, oddly enough, never has said precisely what Sandusky is supposed to have done to him, despite numerous attempts by the police to get him to say something. Eventually, they sort of threw their hands up and gave up. Shubin at first wouldn't let them talk to him at all by himself, insisted that he be present. The police didn't want that. Eventually, after many, many attempts to get him to say something, he said, well, you know, he might have done something to me, but he didn't really say what. Finally, many years later, last year, he testified, and he said that he had been abused. Didn't say exactly how, and didn't in fact say who. Didn't even say it was Sandusky who abused me. So the whole case with the shower incident with Mike McQuarrie smells highly of fish.
Well, the whole thing just, it's amazing, Mark. I'm an old newsman, and I was a fair investigative reporter in my time, and this entire book that you have written, you wrote it like a newsman. That's what makes it so gripping and effective. You've just laid out the facts, and what I have gleaned from reading your book, I became more and more incredulous as I went along, as to I can't believe this is what happened, but the way I added up is that this all began from a couple of reports, both of which turned out to be nothings, but then the local PD decided that.
Hello. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi, I lost you for a minute there, sorry.
Am I back?
The local PD decided to go after it, yeah. So,
yeah,
they took it
to a prosecutor who had already made up her mind. Then they did all of this, they got to these repressed memory therapists, although that therapy has been pretty much repudiated. And then there were contingency lawyers involved, of course, who all of them are going to be really interested in taking somebody to the cleaners. The jury that was seated, finally, there were people who stated clearly they'd made up their minds. And although the defense counsel objected, the judge seated them. It was a hanging judge. He had an extremely poor defense team, and several of these young men, all of whom had been troubled boys from sketchy backgrounds, now telling their stories differently every time they told it, all claiming they hadn't remembered any of this until recently. And let's not forget, Penn State's offer to pay off the victims before any legal action had hardly begun. This was just, I can't believe this.
It's a pretty amazing story. Yeah, yeah. Well, what happened was Sandusky would mentor children. He started a program called the Second Mile to try to help troubled youth. And at first it was a place for foster kids and sort of a halfway house, but then it evolved into him helping thousands of kids. And Sandusky, as you said, was kind of a big kid himself. He had grown up in a recreation center that his father and mother ran. They lived on the second floor. And the only shower there was a communal shower in the center itself. So he grew up, throwing water balloons, being a goofball, and showering with men and other boys. So as part of befriending these kids, he was a big believer in exercise, in schoolwork, and he would try to help them do well in school, and he would take them for exercise, and then he would take them to shower often. Not all the time. He said, he told me, not nearly as much as what they're talking about here. So in 1998, he took a shower with a kid, and his mother discovered this and was very, very upset and turned him into the police. And the police even mounted a sting operation to try to overhear him say something horrible. And the first time, he didn't say anything. The second time, supposedly, he said, I feel terrible about this. I wish I was dead. Sandusky, this was not tape recorded. Sandusky says he would never say something like that. But he might have said, I feel terrible if you're telling me that the boy was upset by the shower because, I didn't mean to upset him. But he never, ever said he did anything to the kid. Now, we have what the kid said. We have the transcript of the interview that the police and the Child Protective Services did with this kid the day after the shower in 1988. And they used terrible interviewing technique where they went after him over and over again to try to get him to say that something had happened, and he wouldn't. So here is where, let me just read you a little bit of that interview, if you don't mind. It's on page 19. Okay. At any time in the shower, did Jerry's penis look like it was erect? No. Not at all? No. Okay. At what point did Jerry then, what did he do to you then? Well, first, like he was pretending to try to squeeze my guts out. He just trying to get the soap out of my hair, and he lifted me up. But he lifted me up pretty high. My feet was just around his waist. My back was touching his chest. Are you telling me he never touched you any place that was inappropriate? No, he did not. Did he ever ask you to touch him in any place inappropriate? No. Okay, do you know what a good touch is and a bad touch is? Yes, I do. What is a good touch? A good touch is like shaking your hand or something and a hug, and a bad touch is like touching something that you're not supposed to touch. Okay, and I'm going to ask you, this is real important, but you tell me, did Jerry ever touch you in a place that was inappropriate? No, he did not. Okay, this is the last time I'm going to say this, okay, and I want you to know this is very important. It's very important. See, we don't want to get anybody in trouble that doesn't deserve to be. Do you feel that Jerry touched you in an inappropriate way when he lifted you up? No, I don't think so. Did he ever touch you on your private parts? No. I mean, this is absolutely terrible, terrible interviewing because it's clear what he wanted to say. You're not supposed to lead people like this. But despite the leading, he didn't say anything. In fact, this kid, whose name was Zach Constance, never came up with something, although he eventually decided that maybe he had repressed the memory and had blacked out. But he never actually said that he remembered Sandusky doing anything. Despite that, Sandusky was found guilty of molesting him because he had been, quote, grooming him to molest him, that sort of
thing. How much did Penn State pay him?
Well, they paid an average of $2 or $3 million to each of these people. I'm not sure what the exact figures are because they haven't revealed that.
You were talking about the police interviews, and they did fully tape one police interview, and in which they forgot to shut off the recorder during a break, and we could hear them talking about leading the witnesses and pumping them, trying to get them to say more.
That's true. That was their star victim, so to speak, whose name was, come on now, let me find the star victim chapter. I'm blanking on the name.
Was it Houts?
Swisher. Swisher Houts, that's right, Brett.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let me find the – now, he was very cooperative eventually. At first, he wouldn't say anything, but then he became their star witness. And he had been somebody that Sandusky had worked so hard with to try to get him to, you know, to be a good student, et cetera. And he clearly just had contempt for Sandusky's efforts. So they introduced letters in the trial that Sandusky had written to Brett, and they called them love letters. But in fact, this is what he said. They were coach letters. You care a little when you can impress your peers, that you hang out with players, or when you are given something. You care a little when you can impress some young lady. There's no real feeling. Your words mean nothing. You have no loyalty. You have no appreciation. You have no work ethic. There's no substance to your agreements. You live moment to moment. You are faltering in school. You listen to nobody but yourself. You don't want anybody in your life to try to help you. You discard them. So this does not exactly sound like a molester. At any rate,
well, all of these young men who he was dealing with, and all of these young men who came forward, were part of this program. So they, all of them, basically started out from what we would say the other side of the tracks. So he's trying
That's
to
true.
Push them along.
That's true. He was trying to, you know, and there was a pattern that emerged. Generally speaking, when they became young teens, they would become, you know, they weren't as impressed that this coach guy was, you know, getting them free sports equipment that he'd gotten donated to him for, you know, because he was a coach or whatever. And they wanted to go out and do drugs and party and be promiscuous with girls. And they didn't want to hang out with Jerry Sandusky anymore. And so that was often what happened. And he got very, very frustrated with this. Anyway, let me read you a little bit of what the police
Let me interrupt you for just a moment there, please, Mark. I'd like to explain to the audience, in case you seem a bit distracted, Mark Pendergrast has written a lot of books about a lot of subjects. So if this isn't, you know, right on top of his mind at the moment, although I believe this is a remarkable work. So I'm sorry. I had to put that in.
Well, thank you. Thank you. No, I wrote it a year ago, so I'm just refreshing myself here myself. So here is what Joe Leiter, the detective, said on this tape when they thought the tape was not running. And the lawyer was there in this case. His name was Andreozzi. Can we at some point in time say to him, Houts, listen, we've interviewed other kids, and other kids have told us that there was intercourse and that they have admitted this, you know. Is there something else that you want to tell us? By the way, that's not true at this point.
Right.
They hadn't gotten any.
Right.
Leiter saw no problem. Yep, we do that with all the kids. We say, listen, this is what we found so far. You fit the pattern of all the other ones. This is the way he operates. And the other kids we dealt with have told us that this has happened after this happened. Did that happen to you?
They were telling these kids that Jerry Sandusky was guilty already.
They were telling him he was guilty. They were lying about what other kids had told them. And they were saying, you know, they said about the kid that started this whole thing, Aaron Fisher, victim one, who we'll talk about in a minute. We had a kid in here the other day who thinks the world of him, Sandusky. We never got that far with him. I think we're going to talk with him again because he left here. In fact, I said to him, you know, we're done with you now. You're shot. Your mind is absolutely a sponge. I mean, this is a horrible thing to do, sit these kids down. I keep calling them kids, but in fact they were young men. Sit these people down, and then they realize, oh, man, I didn't realize that's what he was doing this whole time.
None of them had any memories at all of this originally.
So then when they bring the kid back in, they say, before we start again, I just want to let you know you are not the first victim we have spoken to. We have interviewed 9 adults, and you are doing very well. You're doing very well. But, you know, and then they wanted him to say that there was oral sex, and that became sort of the holy grail for them, and eventually he did. Now, let's go back to Aaron Fisher a second. This kid was only 15 years old when they began to, when his mother suspected that he was abused, and his mother, according to the next door neighbor, was really in it for the money. She saw this as a golden way to get a lot of money, and you'll see a picture of her in my book that she posted on MySpace, very proud of herself for being drunk at a bar, saying, that's me at the saloon, who knows who that guy is, lol, laugh out loud. So she liked Sandusky taking her kid because it would allow her to go and party. But she then decided that he must have done something bad to him. Now, Fisher said at first that after they had wrestled around, Sandusky would hug him tight and crack his back, which is something that I will tell you, I used to be a wrestler, and I used to have people step on my back to crack it because it felt good.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, not too surprising. So they asked him at Child Protective Services, well, did you both have your clothes on? Yes, we did. We both had our clothes on. That was it. That was what he said. So they suspected something must have happened besides this. They handed him off to a therapist who happened to be upstairs named Mike Gillum. And Gillum was absolutely sure that something had happened to him, and he proceeded to sort of educate him about how he might have repressed the memories.
He was a repressed memory guy.
Well, he claimed he wasn't. But if you read, I mean, they ended up writing a book about this.
Yeah.
Gillum and Aaron Fisher and his mother. It was ghostwritten by somebody, but they, you know, did the interviews for it. So we know what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And this is amazing. So he says, if I'm lucky, the children who were abused just acknowledged spontaneously without too much prodding. But with other ones, he asks yes or no questions. It's like that old kid's game of hide the button, where the kid says yes when you get closer and no when you're on a cold trail. And this is absolutely classically bad interviewing technique, very, very leading, where you don't have to say anything yourself. I'll just guess.
Yeah.
And you nod your head, et cetera. So Gillum kept telling him that he knew he was abused. He said, though I knew he was 15, I couldn't get over how young he looked, and his mental function and maturity appeared to be that of a 12-year-old as well. So he finally got him to say yes to some things, and he claims he got him to say yes to oral sex, although he told the police no for several months after that.
Yeah,
so
and they
here's
just kept
another
pushing.
Thing. He kept pushing and pushing and pushing. So after Gillum explained to him that this behavior of Sandusky was really grooming behavior, that he was a classic profile of a predator, Fisher said, I was good at pushing the memories of abuse all away. Once the weekends with Jerry were over, I managed to lock it all deep inside my mind somehow. That was how I dealt with it until the next time. Mike has explained a lot to me since this all happened. He said that what I was doing is called compartmentalizing. I was in such denial about everything. So it's very, very clear that this was repressed memory. So, and Aaron Fisher, oddly enough, he's from Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, and there's a guy named John Ziegler who did a lot of digging on this case, and there's a whole chapter about him in the book.
I saw that.
And he dug up lots and lots of people who knew Fisher who didn't believe a word of this from his hometown. And Fisher himself complained bitterly that, you know, nobody would believe him from his own hometown. So a lot of people ask me, Van, if I was able to interview the victims, the claimed victims in the case. And by the way, they were referred to by the prosecution and by the judge as victims, not alleged victims,
exactly,
the whole way through the trial,
yeah,
which is not a good plan. Anyway, I was only able to interview one of these young men. His name is Dustin. I named them all, by the way, and the media has irritated me by calling all of them victim one, victim two, victim three, victim four, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
So, but their names are public. They're in the public record. They're, you know, in the trial transcript. So Dustin Struble, victim number seven, told me that this was all repressed memories. He said, yeah, both of my therapists have thought I repressed memories, and I didn't remember any of this until I went to the police. And then I got into therapy. And the reason that my testimony changed so much between my grand jury testimony and what I said at the trial was, and he said this during the trial, he said, that doorway that I had closed has since been reopening more. More things have been coming back, and things have changed since that grand jury testimony. Through counseling and different things, I can remember a lot more detail that I had just pushed aside than I did at that point.
Now, come on, let's be honest. How much of that came, how much of that is, do you think, because I think, how much of that is a consequence of having a contingency lawyer who sees millions in settlements out there that he's going to get a hand on, pushing him that direction?
Well, I think that that is the case with probably many of these. Having met Struble and talked to him and then corresponded with him, I don't actually think that that was his largest motivation, although I interviewed him in a house he had just bought with a brand new car that he just bought with his
from
money.
His settlement.
So
yeah.
There's no, yeah. So there's no question he had the money, but he was very, I think, naive and very convinced that all of this had happened. And he said it during his testimony. He said, you know, that testimony is what I had recalled at that time. Though, again, through counseling, through talking about things, I have remembered a great deal more things that I blocked out. And at that time, that was, yes, that's what I thought. But at this time, that has changed. So,
well, all of these people, I'm sorry again, but all of these people who have been making these claims, these then boys and now men who are making these claims, while this was supposedly happening to them, one of them even claimed that he was held hostage in the Sandusky's basement for 3 days on a weekend and not fed and sexually abused and he screamed and et cetera and nobody came. But next week, he went back again. They kept going back to the Sandusky's.
That's right, because, of course, they had repressed the memory the whole time, supposedly. Although in that case, I do think that it was money. I mean, basically, they got... They had six people, including Zach Constas, who never actually claimed he did anything, and others who claimed very mild things, basically. And then they had Brett Houts, who was their star victim, who would say anything whatsoever that you wanted him to. But then, after this became very, very public with the grand jury presentment, of November 2011, it became extremely clear that they were going to hand out a lot of money from Penn State. And that's when the contingency lawyers got extremely excited. And that's when you had people like Sebastian Payton making extraordinary claims. And I don't think those were repressed memory cases. They didn't have time, for one thing. I think they were simply after the money.
Jumping on the bandwagon.
And I think that most of the ones since then, which, you know, there were some who claimed that, you know, they had told Joe Paterno about this back in the 70s or 80s, and that Paterno had turned a blind eye to it. That's absolutely preposterous. I mean, you know, one of the horrible things about this case is the ruination of Joe Paterno's reputation. Ironically, he and Sandusky did not really get along. Paterno was not trying to protect Sandusky.
No.
That's not what happened in this case.
And a whole chain of those men going up the line all the way to the university president ended up in ruination over this, ended up with actual criminal charges filed against them.
That's right, and ended up spending some time in prison, two of them. So it's, and, you know, I'm not sure what will happen to the former president. I call this a moral panic, and it is a classic example of what can happen when the media jumps on a bandwagon. When it's, and I'll tell you, I appreciate being able to talk to you because my book has been almost universally blackballed.
And I don't understand that at all.
Well, it's true. It has been ignored by Penn State. It has been ignored by the sports press. And I reached out, you know, through LinkedIn and other places to many, many, many people when the book came out. And it's been enormously frustrating. And there's so many ironies to this. The Paterno family didn't like John Ziegler going on television, and he held up this document of Alan Myers saying nothing had happened in the shower on television, on national television, on the Today Show and on CNN. Nobody asked to read it. Nobody asked to look at it. And the Paternos were appalled because they had decided the way they were going to play this was that Sandusky had fooled them and was guilty as hell, and so they wouldn't have anything to do with anything trying to say that Sandusky was innocent. It's, and they've never had much to do with me either. I've tried to talk to them and failed. And it's bizarre because, of course, if Sandusky didn't abuse anyone, then obviously Paterno wasn't covering up anything. And he wasn't covering up anything.
No.
You know, he did what he was supposed to do. When Mike McQuarrie came to him, he passed this up the line and told his boss, and who told his boss, who told his boss, who was the university president, and they all concluded that he'd been, you know, horse playing around in the shower, which was, in fact, what he had been doing.
And they ended up with criminal charges. Yeah. I'll tell you, besides just the rush to judgment, as is in your title, to me it's like it was public hysteria. It reminds me of the Salem witch trials.
Well, it was very similar. And you had, you know, President Obama basically calling him guilty publicly and saying, you know, we have to watch out for things like this and we all need to be careful. The President of the United States said that.
Yeah.
So the other irony involved here is that Sandusky had no pornography on his computer or in his home. Not adult, not child, nothing. It's very unusual for someone who is attracted to children. Who did have pornography were the prosecutors, who were happily sending gross, really grotesque racist pornography and sexist pornography back and forth to each other by email, which all came out as a result of the investigation of how the Sandusky case was prosecuted.
Well, the other thing that goes on here is that The other thing is that I think we can all of us agree that most of these sorts of things, any kind of a sexual predator, is mostly testosterone driven, and yet did not Jerry Sandusky historically have low testosterone levels?
Yeah, he had very low testosterone and still does. That's why he and Dottie, his wife, had to adopt children. They adopted 6 children. And he is being treated for testosterone now, for low testosterone, in prison. So that should have come out at trial. It didn't. I mean, his defense lawyers, to their credit, tried to quit right before the trial and said, "We're totally unprepared. People are going to look back at this as a joke." And the judge wouldn't let them, and they should have quit anyway, but they didn't. But they did an absolutely hideous job. The main guy was named Joe Amendola, and he couldn't hear very well. So he often didn't hear what people were saying.
He did a terrible job
in terms of jury selection. And he made statements that seemed to, you know, his opening statement was unbelievable, which he said later he was being sarcastic, but give me a break. This is the first thing you say is the state has overwhelming evidence against my client.
Yeah.
I'm facing a major uphill battle like climbing Mount Everest.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And the judge allowed, in the opening statement, the prosecutor was allowed to talk about how they had blocked these memories out, and he showed blown-up pictures of them as children with the implication that, you know, these poor boys had been abused. So much about this case is incredible. There was what I call the phantom victim, a victim who never existed at all, that a janitor supposedly saw. And that janitor,
Now suffering from dementia.
Now suffering from dementia, but what I found, and so it was secondhand hearsay evidence that was allowed into court and should have been inadmissible in the first place. But it turns out the police had tape recorded an interview with Jim Calhoun before he went totally around the bend, and he insisted that yes, he had seen someone giving oral sex to an older boy, which may have been a football player, in the shower. But when he was asked if it was Coach Sandusky, he very vehemently said, no, it was not Coach Sandusky. I know him. No, it was not him.
And the defense lawyer missed that entirely.
Yeah, and he claims he heard it but decided not to play it, which I don't believe.
No.
Either he's utterly incompetent, or I think he never listened to it. He said he had, you know, like 12,000 pages of stuff to read, all these tapes. He never listened to that. I'm quite sure he didn't, or he would have played it. He never called Alan Myers to the stand, which he should have, to say what he never introduced that statement I told you about in the shower. Was never introduced at trial because they were afraid that then the prosecution would say, well, now he's saying otherwise. Well, so what? You know, you should have had that in there. Anyway.
So Jerry Sandusky sits in jail right now, still in prison. And do they still have him in solitary on a suicide watch?
No, thank goodness. Most of the time that I was writing the book, they had him in a solitary confinement. And every time they would have him taken anywhere else, he would go through this whole rigmarole of having all of his items taken away and not restored. And there was a guard who had it in for him. He thought he was going to drown from urine and feces at one point when it overflowed from another prisoner. One of the things that this book is revealing about is not just the Sandusky case, but the way that our prison system treats people. You know, if I can go off on my high horse for a minute, we have more people in prison in this country than any other country in the world, both per capita and in total numbers. and many of them, not the majority, many, but a sizable minority of them, are innocent. And many, many of those are black or African Americans. So
absolutely.
Sandusky, in a way, I felt guilty about focusing just on his case because he's a prominent white guy. But the fact that it could happen to him, just imagine, and he had at least, you know, a support network and money enough to hire a lawyer, even though he wasn't the best in the world. Just imagine what happens if you're accused of, falsely accused of abusing children, which is a very, very high profile crime, and you didn't do it. Well, you're toast if you don't have any money. Many, many people take plea bargains. In fact, one of the reasons I concluded that Sandusky was innocent was that he refused any plea bargain, didn't make any attempt to take one. But many people who are innocent take plea bargains because they're facing a choice of either facing, you know, 20 years or the rest of their life in prison, or saying, okay, I did something they didn't do. And
well, Jerry Sandusky
only, like,
has
two years.
Jerry Sandusky has never wavered from proclaiming his innocence, and I can't remember who the expert it was that you quoted in your book as saying that some sexual predator expert or something who said that they all start off proclaiming their innocence and then almost universally they all break down and they just start making up excuses for it, and the only one that person had ever seen who continued to proclaim innocence actually turned out to be found innocent.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, there were so many. The first thing I did was to interview Sandusky's five children who remain convinced that he's innocent. And they all told me the same thing. Dad is a big kid. We had a wonderful childhood full of games and happiness and family outings. And Mom and Dad are great people. And we don't believe a word of this. And those second-mile kids, he treated them just like he treated us. And yes, he's a touchy-feely, huggy guy, but no, he didn't abuse us. Now, let me talk about Matt Sandusky, the one kid that turned on him.
Yeah.
Because I think many, many people, and Matt has now made a career out of going around talking about this. He never testified at the trial because he flipped in the middle of the trial. But he's the reason that Sandusky himself never got to testify, because his lawyer decided that because Matt was now saying that his father had abused him, that if they called Jerry, that would open the door for Matt to testify. So they didn't have him testify.
Right.
But this is, you know, I was able to be in touch with the woman that Matt had an affair with, who was living with the Sanduskys, and how they attempted suicide. And now Matt represents this as that he attempted suicide because he was being abused. But she didn't say that at all. She said he never mentioned anything like that to me. And then he told the police that he was just beginning to get back repressed memories in the middle of the trial.
Sure.
And the police said, well, do you remember oral sex? And he said, no, not yet. So then he goes on Oprah and he tells her, yeah, now he remembers the oral sex. And he said, for him to have done those things to me, for him to have performed oral sex on me, forced me to do the same to him, for him to kiss me on the mouth. And then Oprah interrupts and says, did he ever try to anally penetrate you? Yes, I mean, he did digitally with his fingers, and he did try, but I was never anally penetrated. So based on what you're telling me, Winfrey said, you actually repressed a lot of it. Uh-huh, absolutely. The physical part is the part, you know, you can erase. My child
self... So we've got
self,
seven, So we've got seven or eight guys here who now claim all of these things happened, and none of them could, you know, none of them remembered it directly right away. None of them could just say, oh yeah, that happened to me too. I mean, seven or eight people who can't remember anything. I'm sorry.
Well, it was the first. That's actually true of the two later ones too that came after the grand jury presentment. First, they were just six, which included the phantom victim who never existed, and which included Zach Constas, and which included others who said nothing had ever happened to start with. But then, once it became clear that all the money was coming,
yes,
people said immediately, oh yeah, he did this to me, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
And, you know, Penn State did no vetting at all, that I can see, of these cases. They just wanted it all to go away, and they threw money at people.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, Mark, you've convinced. I'm as I say, I'm an old newsman. I'm a natural cynic, and when I first knew that I was probably going to be talking to you, and I saw the title of your book, I'm thinking, yeah, the rush to judgment. But I'll tell you, your storytelling, your facts are impeccable. And I'm on your side now. I'm convinced that the entire system was just ready to go bonkers, which it did, and poor Jerry Sandusky was standing right there.
Yep. And you know, the Free report that Louis Free did was a travesty. Ignored a lot of stuff.
I found it interesting that the former FBI director Free comes in with this report that's just lambastes everybody, and yet the FBI themselves did a report that pretty much found the opposite.
Well, it wasn't the FBI, but it was a government agency, and the guy who investigated interviewed a whole bunch of people, and this was right after the grand jury presentment came out, and basically concluded that nothing had happened, that there was no cover-up. He was focusing primarily on Graham Spanier, the college president, but he concluded that the whole thing was, you know, nothing. It was a big to-do over nothing. And John Ziegler, who is a very diligent researcher. He can be an abrasive personality, but boy, he has been on this case before I was and for a long time. And he has a website called framingpaterno.com, which I highly recommend that people look at. And his career was basically ruined from trying to scream from the mountaintops what had happened in this case. And as I said, I've been basically ignored. So it's been a very frustrating experience. So I hope
it's got to
know,
have been.
Let me say one other thing. I say this in every interview. Please, people, get the book. You can buy it on Amazon. It's a paperback. And I think Van will testify, it's pretty long, but it's not hard to read. And
it's
read
very
it,
easy.
You know, because unless you read it, you're not going to believe this.
No.
You know, I can't convey it to you in the space of an hour.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, Mark, the first, I'm flabbergasted. I'm also angry and embarrassed that the society in which I live could behave so much like those historical Puritans of Salem witch days. I really almost have no words after reading this. Mark, this is one of the most significant books I have read in years. Thank you for your work and for sharing it.
Well, thank you for reading it and for bringing it to people's attention.
Okay. Folks, seldom are you going to hear me tout something as a must-read, but this ranks right up there in my mind with Bob Woodward's newly released expose, Fear. You'll be able to find this wherever they sell books. The Most Hated Man in America. It's by Mark Pendergrast, and it is a must-read. This has been the Author's Interview from Sunbury Press.